Climate change takes center stage as the Democrats debate in Miami. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, how will the candidates for president tackle climate change? What are your questions? Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, just how vulnerable is Florida to rising seas and warming temperatures? A local analysis is underway. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, climate change and Florida. The Democratic candidates for president are in Florida now and getting ready to debate in Miami tonight and tomorrow. And as the debates get underway, dozens of medical and public health groups are calling on the candidates to make a commitment to combat climate change. They're framing it as a public health emergency. Dr. Mona Sarfati is director of the Program for Climate and Health at the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University, and she's on the line now. Dr. Sarfati, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. How important is climate change to you as an issue in the 2020 election? What are your concerns and questions about Florida's vulnerability to climate change impacts? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Weigh in on our Facebook page as well. And so, Doctor, on Monday, 74 medical and public health groups aligned as one to push for the Democratic candidates to put together firm commitments to combat climate change and look at it as a public health emergency. Tell me a little bit more about the messaging public health advocates are putting out this week as the Democrats debate.
Sure. So we want everyone to know that climate change is one of the greatest threats to health that America has ever faced. It's a true public health emergency. The health, safety, and well-being of millions of people have already been harmed by human-caused climate change right here in the United States. And health risks in the future are dire without urgent action to fight climate change. Climate change is also exacerbating health inequities and disproportionately harming the most vulnerable people amongst us. Therefore, we have to pay attention to equity as we face and try to accelerate climate action. We want all public officials, current, future, to know that. And we want people in the business sector and other sectors of the economy to be aware of this as well, that climate change is a great, it's a public health emergency, probably the greatest public health emergency that the country's ever faced.
And you said it's already happening in terms of impacts to public health. Give the listeners out there some examples of that, if you could. What are some examples?
So climate change is creating a health emergency because it threatens the foundations of what we need to thrive. We need clean air, we need clean water, nutritious food, and vibrant, healthy communities. And climate change is harming our health and threatening our safety because of extreme heat, torrential rains, large wildfires, displacement that occurs because of these extreme events, infectious and insect-borne diseases, mosquito and tick diseases specifically. And all of these are threats to health. Different parts of the country face different threats, depending upon where you live. You have a different vulnerability, but they all amount to threatening Americans' health, and everyone's at risk, but certain people are more vulnerable. Children are more vulnerable because they spend more time outside. Pregnant women are more vulnerable because it turns out they're also more vulnerable to heat. The elderly are more vulnerable, especially if they lack air conditioning, and people who have any kind of a chronic condition, like a heart condition or a lung condition, are especially vulnerable. In addition, those who work outside are more vulnerable, and people who are living in low-income communities and communities of color are also more affected.
And if you're just tuning in, as the Democrats debate tonight and tomorrow in Miami, climate change takes center stage this year as a campaign issue. What are your thoughts and questions about medical professionals urging the candidates to call climate change a public health emergency? We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937. And the moment has arrived in terms of political will, Dr. Sarfati. According to a new survey from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication and Climate Nexus, the majority of voters in Florida, more than 70%, rank climate change as an important issue, including over 80% of Democrats. So this is squarely in the wheelhouse of the Democratic candidates for president. There are a lot of candidates for president on the Democratic side, and they are not all on the same page about how they will attack this issue if they are elected president. In fact, there's a strong internal Democratic climate debate going on right now, revolving mainly around the precepts of the Green New Deal, as it's called. It is seen as too progressive, too aggressive among some factions in the Democratic Party in terms of what it calls for to address climate change. However, your group is pushing for some form of carbon pricing, and medical professionals have united around that as part of a time reduction of fossil fuel extraction in the U.S. And so can you share a little bit more about where public health organizations stand and what are their biggest policy priorities for addressing climate change? What would you like to see the next president do?
Well, first of all, we want everyone to know that the actions that will reduce the impact of climate change can also improve human health. So this is if we address climate change, it's a win-win because most of the solutions are good for health. And the solutions that we're advocating are, first of all, that we should meet and strengthen our commitment made under the Paris Climate Agreement. The Paris Climate Agreement will get us a good portion of the way, but it won't get us as far as we need to go. And so we need even stronger commitments than what we had under the Paris Agreement. We have to transition away from the use of coal and oil and natural gas to clean, safe, and renewable energy and energy efficiency. A tremendous amount of progress could be made just by paying attention to energy efficiency and increasing the efficiency in buildings, increasing insulation, and so forth. We need to emphasize active transportation and public transportation so that we can move away from the high carbon transportation systems that we're relying on. We also need to promote healthy, sustainable, and resilient farms and food systems, forests, natural lands. We need to ensure that all United States residents have access to safe and affordable drinking water and a sustainable water supply. So there are a number of things that need to be done, and the health community has come together to make sure that the country is aware that we think that climate change is a health emergency and that everyone is at risk, but some people are at greater risk. And there's a list of things that are not hard to list that need to be done that all leaders, government leaders, business leaders, civil society leaders, all candidates for elected office, need to attend to this list of must-dos. This is our to-do list, and it's really essential.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, Doctor. There's bipartisan awareness and support across the country now of climate change as an important issue that needs to be addressed. At the same time, partisanship is driving divisions, really, continuing divisions in America over how we address climate change, even though really it shouldn't be a partisan issue. It is. As just one example, in Oregon, state lawmakers there fled the Capitol for several days to block a climate change bill that the governor and Democrats in the Oregon state legislature were trying to approve. Not enough Democrats signed on to support it either. It was a bill that would require businesses to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Republicans fled the state capitol in Florida. Some of them even aligned with armed militia groups to express their opposition to this. It gives you an idea of how difficult enacting policy changes around this issue will be. And so as a health professional, you're saying this is a public health issue. But what about the politics of this? Because they're pretty difficult. What about that?
Well, Americans are moving in their opinions very substantially, especially over the last several years. There are more people in the United States now who say that climate change is personally important to me. than ever before. There, it's now about 73% of the people who say that climate change is personally important to me. And from what I understand, the public opinion has moved quite a bit in Florida specifically, where many people who are voters now feel that this is one of the most important voting issues. So as public opinion moves and shifts, politicians will respond to it. And we've already seen a great deal of progress in that regard, but more people need to know about these issues. They need to know that this is an emergency. And so programs like yours that provide us an opportunity to get the word out there are just crucial. And we'd like people to tell their neighbors. Tell your neighbors. Tell your family members. Talk to those you work with about this, that climate change is a health emergency, and that we have to do something about it, and we need to vote on it. We need to let our elected officials know that we consider it an emergency and we want action.
Certainly here in Florida, there is less of a partisan split given our incredible vulnerability to climate change. Sea level rise will impact Florida almost more than any other state. And so facts on the ground, particularly in South Florida, where Miami is experiencing regular sunny day flooding and other impacts, are dictating a public works, a municipal response to this. What are your thoughts about the way local governments in particular and state governments are not waiting for federal action? They are moving ahead now with trying to figure out what to do about this.
No question about it. Local communities are being impacted, and public officials are taking action. Communities are working with their leaders and trying to make sure that problems like sea level rise are being addressed. They're trying to make sure that people have a place to go when the heat index becomes dangerously high. In many cities, there are now cooling centers that people can go to when the heat becomes intolerable. So local communities are facing, are confronting these problems directly and realize that they need solutions. What goes on in the national political scene is important, but local communities still need to deal directly with the conditions that they're experiencing. So there's a great deal going on in local communities and at the state level as well. There are 9 states in the Northeast that have had a regional greenhouse gas initiative in place for 10 years now. And they have driven down their carbon emissions very significantly. It doesn't get a lot of attention. I'm not sure why. It should be better known. And studies that have been done of that regional greenhouse gas initiative show that it has saved lives and saved money because there's less being spent on health problems and there's less hospitalization, there are less emergency room visits, there are fewer premature babies, and all of this is also providing health savings, dollars that are much needed by local communities so that they can address some of these other problems.
Let's go to your calls now as we talk about climate change as a 2020 campaign issue. What are your questions? 549-2937. T is in St. Augustine. Hey, T, good morning. How are you?
Hi, good morning. So my question is the fact that, you know, climate is something that since the beginning of time, we have never had control over. And I support climate reformation, but I just think it's an impossible task. If we, since the beginning of time, have never addressed this issue, and we have failed to have any proper steps or litigation towards the issue, how can we expect to make it something with respect to public health? Thank you very much.
Okay. Dr. Sarfati, could you answer his question, his perception that we do not have control over addressing warming temperatures and all the other impacts related to climate change and carbon emissions? With respect to that caller, and I appreciate his sincere question, the science is clear that we do, in fact, have control and that rapid decarbonization of our environment will make a big impact. Can you address his question, please?
You know, 97% of all the climate scientists, this isn't all scientists, but it's climate scientists, are clear that it's human actions that have caused the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to rise at an unprecedented rate. So there have been variations in the atmosphere before, but the rate of change, the rate of increase of carbon dioxide has been since the start of the Industrial Revolution, really, which is a little over 100 years. And the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere has gone up during this time, and the amount of heat that is kept in our atmosphere has risen during this period of time. So that's all established science. And since we put the carbon dioxide up there, we can change the way we live so that we can address the problem. It's really important for people to realize that this is something that we need action on, and it's by agreement of communities and leaders and so forth that we can get that action. This is an emergency. We can't afford to just continue to ignore it. We have to act and implement solutions.
And in fact, the United Nations, the scientific community, there's consensus that we've got about a decade left to avoid what could be a catastrophic tipping point in terms of the pace of warming. Let me ask you, do you support the Green New Deal, which has been championed by more progressive Democrats, or not?
We have a program that we would like the country to know about. It's a very carefully thought through program. And it's available on our website, which is climatehealthaction.org, climatehealthaction.org. And it lists all the things that we know will help to address the problem, and not just decrease the rate of climate change, but also help to address what some communities are facing. So we think we need to meet and strengthen the commitments the U.S. made under the Paris Climate Agreement. We need to transition away from the use of coal, oil, natural gas to clean, safe, and renewable energy and energy efficiency. We need to emphasize active transportation. We need healthy and resilient farms and food systems and forests and natural lands. And we need to ensure that all U.S. residents have access to safe and affordable drinking water. And we need to invest in policies that support a transition for those workers and communities that are already being adversely impacted by climate change. So there's a list of things there. And, people can find it at climatehealthaction.org if you want to see the full list and a little bit more detail.
Okay. Those are all important points to make. Let me ask you as a follow-up. It's easier said than done for candidates to talk about this issue in terms of top-line bullet points. It's more difficult to have the conversation about how to overcome fossil fuel industry opposition, ramp down emissions, scale up renewals rapidly. These will be wrenching changes. And so what's your response to those who say that enacting these types of massive changes to the global economy will be incredibly difficult and politically challenging? How to address that? That is a sticky wicket.
No question about it. This is a complex problem. We didn't create this problem in a day, and it's going to take time to address it. But the basic starting point is for us to agree that we have a very serious problem before us and that we need to come together to address it. So getting to that level of consensus means that people everywhere need to know and need to be able to say that this is the case, that we've got to come together and we have to make sure we have solutions to this problem that confronts us so that we can figure out how to overcome our differences and how to solve our political problems that are getting in the way. None of this is going to be changed overnight. We need to think in terms of some years to get it done. But unless we decide that it must get done, we won't start on that process. So we're already a little bit behind, but that doesn't mean that it's hopeless. Many states have already been moving forward. Florida's got some solutions. The Northeast has its greenhouse gas initiative. Oregon has a plan. New York is working, is just committed to getting to 100% renewable energy. And they're talking about building a great deal more offshore wind turbines so that they can provide the energy that's needed. There are other places that are putting offshore wind turbines in place. Iowa already gets 40% of its electricity from wind energy. The Southwest has tremendous potential for solar energy if it took that mission seriously and decided to move toward that that source of energy on a large scale. So there are many solutions, and different places, depending upon what resources they have different opportunities to move in this direction, which is the reason that state officials, local public officials, and communities need to think about the problem, think about the solutions, and decide how they can move forward and address it so that they are protecting their own citizens and helping to address the larger problem.
If you're just tuning in, dozens of public health organizations, including the American Lung Association, the American College of Physicians, and more, are urging candidates for president to address climate change urgently as a public health emergency. Lots of calls. Let's go to Greg in Jacksonville. Hi, Greg. Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
My question is in regards on more of a global scale. It's us as a country are leading and doing everything by the book to be the cleanest we can be. My question is more of how is the candidates and the future of our government going to be able to deal with the world and the other governments of the world, such as like China or India, who have some of the highest CO2 emissions and plastic pollutions in the world. If we do everything, I guess my real story, quit beating around the bush, is if we do everything by the book and these other countries don't get on, nothing's going to change. I feel like it's kind of like cancels each other out. What is the candidate's future like proposals for countries such as China and such as India, who do have the highest emissions?
Right. Yeah.
What are her plans about trying to remediate those problems?
Thanks for that question, Greg.
I'll take the answer off the air.
I appreciate that, Doctor. You know, that's come up a lot when you talk about this issue. If the U.S. gets much more aggressive on this, will it make an appreciable difference if other major polluters don't also follow suit?
No question that China and India and some other places in the world need to address their own carbon footprint. The Paris Agreement was a starting point to get all the countries together to agree that this is a common goal and it's essential for the health of all of the people around the world. So I think, you know, the caller is right. We need to see those other countries act definitively. It's a little bit, it's harder to do that when we have decided that we won't adhere to the Paris Climate Agreement. So getting back into that agreement and accelerating the pace of it is important.
549-2937. Let's go to Todd on the South Side. Hi, Todd.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for covering this topic. A couple quick comments. One is we really do have a public health emergency here. Our Floridians need to learn about what their personal risks are with heat events, with flooding, with hurricanes. So we need to roll up our sleeves to teach people so they're safe. But I want to respond to the comments about China and other countries that are big polluters too. And that is that China and India have real plans to move to 100% renewable energy. We don't have a plan. China and India are making far more solar panels and making a lot of money that we're not making. We do in Jacksonville have a Chinese company that has built a solar panel construction company in Jacksonville, Florida, recognized as a big market here. Why are we losing out? The great opportunities to make have a 30-year plan to move towards renewable energy, and we'll make a lot of money. Yeah, there'll be losers and winners, but there'll be great winners in terms of jobs for installers and contractors and builders of renewable energy facilities. So let's enjoy the benefits that the Chinese and Indians are getting, because they're ahead of us on this. We're missing out. We're just missing out because we don't have an energy plan in Florida.
Todd, thanks for that. Dr. Sarfati, what about that? What about the opportunities that are presenting themselves as the cost of renewables drops and new sectors, new energy sectors are opening up? Is Florida, is the nation missing the boat?
That's a very good question. Well, you know, Florida is a very sunny state, and so clearly the potential for solar power is great there. And given that tourism is such a big piece of the economy, it seems essential that from that economic perspective that the state move very aggressively to do everything it can to be able to protect its basic resources and its own industries, the fishing industry, the tourist industry, snowbird trends of people coming to sunny Florida to enjoy the beaches during the cold winters up north. So all of those are real economic opportunities, and to ignore them is to endanger the economic livelihood of the state.
Lots of tweets about this. Madeline tweets the show. I think some PR campaigns around things like purchasing smaller or more efficient vehicles, advocating for wild spaces, and responsible development could help the policy and legal aspects make this be seen as community-driven. And framing climate change as a public health issue is smart and appropriate. Mara tweets the show, put a price on carbon emissions. Create stronger incentives for renewable energy. Aggressively shift to public transit as our auto infrastructure crumbles. Incentivize sustainable farming and agro practices. And make Mary Heglar, head of the EPA, looks like she is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Okay, the current administration, the Trump administration, as you pointed out earlier, withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement and has installed in cabinet and public policy positions officials who are diametrically opposed to everything you're saying, Dr. Sarfati, not treating this as a public health emergency, talking about bringing back coal as an industry. So what's your response to how the current administration is treating this issue?
My response is that we need people throughout the country to understand how important this is to their own future, to their health, to their children's future, to their grandchildren, and to the grandchildren's children, and that we need them to be involved and to realize that they need to vote based on this and to put public officials into responsible positions who are willing to confront this crisis. So that's really the way that we can address that. Everybody needs to be involved. They need to realize that their own health is at stake, their own children's future is at stake, their grandchildren's future is at stake, and that everybody needs to make this a priority. And Florida has an opportunity to do that. It seems that it's already moving in that direction, and it can go a great deal farther. And yes, there's tremendous economic opportunity there. Electric cars are selling very actively around the world. Some countries have already decided to permit no more internal combustion engines, which is not something that we would recommend at this point. But we need to move in the direction of low-emitting and low-polluting vehicles so that we can breathe freely, have clean air, benefit our own health, and so on.
We thank you so much for speaking with us, Doctor, as the candidates for president debate this week in Miami, a top issue for Florida and the nation. So Dr. Mona Sarfati, Director of the Program for Climate and Health, the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you.
And up next, we'll tell you how local researchers are examining this city's vulnerability to climate change. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. you were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story. How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that? Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
JU and Mosh present Above and Beyond, a 90-second shortcast during Science Friday on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in for special Chasing the Moon segments starting now through July 12th.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest stories in the state.
From politics to education, the environment, and more. If it's news in Florida, we want to hear from you.
Let your voice be heard. Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at noon on WJCT.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT. Your community, your world.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, in our first segment, we heard about climate change as a 2020 campaign issue. Now we're going to bring it down to the local level. Just how resilient are we here in Jacksonville and the entire First Coast when it comes to the impacts of climate change? Important research is going on right now to take a closer look at that. Elizabeth Payne is the CEO of the Northeast Florida Regional Council, and she joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And it's 549-2937 as we talk about our local resiliency. What are your questions? Now, your organization is actually conducting a resiliency analysis for the First Coast. Tell us about it.
Correct. We are working through some EDA funding, Economic Development Administration funding, working on resiliency in the region as well as economic resiliency. So we have developed a regional resiliency exposure tool, which is an online program where you can type in your address and it will help you understand homeowners and businesses alike their risks, their exposure to risks like sea level rise and storm surge and flooding. Mm-hmm. Giving them a better understanding of their risks in the region.
Because if people can break it down to their specific address, they can maybe get a better sense of what we're facing. Is that right?
Correct. And it's about their understanding to risk, but then we also want to take that next step on their understanding of things that they can do themselves as homeowners and citizens, but also to help their local governments and their communities understand what could work best for them at the community level.
Based on what you know now, what are this region's biggest vulnerabilities? Are we storm surge and flooding?
We certainly recognize that storm surge and flooding are our biggest risks most often. Obviously, wildfire is something that's important, but we're also looking at that community level on what the risks are and what can be, what kind of adaptations that we can do to those risks.
Let's talk about adaptations. And by the way, let me make a plug for our new website here at WJCT, which we are launching before the end of this month, adaptflorida.org, where we will be looking over time at how this community is adapting to these changes. If you're interested, go to adaptflorida.org and opt in now to get updates as we cover this critical issue for Northeast Florida. Adaptation and mitigation, Elizabeth, will be the key words that policymakers, business leaders, researchers like yourself and media will all be examining really closely, because adaptation is going to happen. We're going to have to adapt.
Absolutely. And I think we're all trying to get a sense of how that's going to work best here in Northeast Florida. There's a big diversity in our region from the city of Jacksonville and some of its urban areas, you know, versus some of our inland communities like Clay County and Putnam County that also experience significant effects. We actually are trying to get our hands around those adaptation and mitigation strategies, and we are ourselves launching an initiative on July 1st. We have a survey. We're calling it the Regional Resiliency Survey, and that's going to go out to citizens as well as our local governments, and we want to understand people's understanding of their risks as well as what they think will work in Northeast Florida, what kind of adaptation techniques and mitigation strategies. And we're hoping that that information will help our local governments make better decisions.
getting the public's opinions about this is so important.
Absolutely. This is a politically motivated, and we're hoping that the public's voice should be heard on these strategies that local government should consider.
Now, you at the Northeast Florida Regional Council are also working on economic resiliency, and you're working with the business community on this. How does the business community look at this issue locally? What are they saying to you?
This is a lot about business continuity. It's about understanding how to keep going in the event of disasters. There certainly are significant statistics about those businesses that are forced to close if they're impacted by a disaster after a certain number of days. So it's really about an understanding of the risks, a lot of that public education, and then helping the business community to understand the things that they can do proactively in the preparedness realm to prepare for not being able to open.
You're also working with the U.S. Green Building Council on green and resilient building, because a lot of the changes we'll be seeing will have to do with how we put together buildings, won't they?
Absolutely. There's thoughts on how to build new buildings. There's lots of discussions about that, but we're really targeting how we can change regulations, how homeowners can lift or elevate or have more resilient home systems to really give them a chance to stay where they are and to be able to make it through these disasters.
If you're just tuning in, as we speak with Elizabeth Payne, CEO of the Northeast Florida Regional Council, how would you like to see the First Coast adapt to climate change? It's 549-2937, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. Okay, there are actually two committees or task forces meeting right now in Jacksonville. One is called the Resiliency Committee, looking at how to become a more resilient community. The other one is it's a long title. It's the Adaptation Action Area Working Group on Flooding. And so local government in Jacksonville, along with the mayors out at the beaches, have been starting to look at this more closely. How does the Northeast Florida Regional Council plan on working with government leaders over time as you try to educate people about how to become more resilient?
Sure. One of the things that we work on most often is public engagement. So that's how we're kind of facilitating this public education of exposure to risk and understanding people's wants and needs for adaptation and helping to kind of translate that information to our local governments to help them make better decisions.
Let me ask you a more difficult question. Your predecessor, the former CEO of your organization, would never use the term climate change when he would go out and talk particularly to business groups. He said he would just talk about sea level rise. He'd use the phrase sea level rise. He wouldn't say climate change, because for a significant part of the population, they hear that term and they turn off. They don't want to hear the rest of what you're saying, maybe because they don't accept the scientific consensus around climate change. How do you deal with that?
I think it is difficult. And I think what we recognize as the council is that we are not the scientists and the climate change experts. We simply accept what those people are telling us, the Army Corps, some of the academia that's done this research. What we're doing is trying to move forward with that data and not kind of have the debate and the argument about whether how it's happening. So we really are moving forward that way. Sea level rise is something that is the particular avenue that we're kind of taking in climate change. You know, it's such a broad issue that we can't even begin to fix all of it. So, we've always taken the approach of one piece of it, and sea level rise has always been that component that we've worked on.
Sea level rise is a big problem for Florida, but in Jacksonville, as we learned, river rising is a big problem too. River flooding, we're doubly vulnerable. We've got the ocean and the river to worry about.
Absolutely. And that's something that's a particularly unique challenge here in Northeast Florida. It's always hard to explain to people that not only do we have this risk of the ocean, but this river in their backyard that they're very used to seeing is also very vulnerable. We've seen with vulnerability assessments as counties get started, the western part of Nassau County is extremely vulnerable. Inland Clay County and Putnam County, it's our whole region that's really susceptible to these risks.
In fact, a recent report that ran in national media outlets just the other day found that Jacksonville is going to be the most expensive city in America to secure with seawalls because we have so many miles of coastline and riverfront waterline. Did you see that?
I did. Absolutely. That is an amazing kind of fact and figure when you think about all those cities across the country.
So whether or not we decided to move forward with massive seawalls, it's going to be expensive for Jacksonville, no matter what we do in
yes.
terms of adaptation.
Yes. And I think it's important that we're getting this conversation started. And that's really what we're hoping to do at the council is have this local community conversation, as well as understanding maybe what the region can do as regional solutions.
John is on the south side. Hi, John. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for taking my call. You know, I just wanted to ask your guest, you know, as far as all these different meetings, gosh, I wish I knew about some, because I would love to attend some of them. But my question has to do with the legislation. You know, you can talk about all of this, but ultimately it's going to require legislation. And I saw a bill that was last night at the Jacksonville City Council, and it was 2019-453, and it's the conversion of certain financial reconciliations in order to effectuate the use of the Enterprise Resource Planning Financial System by October 1st. And I haven't looked it up yet, but does that have anything to do with what you're looking to do? And if not, are there other pieces of legislation that have been introduced that address, you know, what you're looking to accomplish, not only in Duval County, but throughout the North Florida region?
Sure. Thanks for that call, John.
John, I think that we are right now less focused on the how to pay for it. That's certainly a very difficult question as we move forward with these adaptation and mitigation strategies. I think we here in Northeast Florida are almost at the very beginning of really talking about what those strategies could be. And then that next phase would be on how to pay for it. But certainly things that all need to be thought about as we move forward in getting these things done.
Let's make a quick plug again for your new survey. Your regional resiliency survey, which is going up Monday, July 1st. You want people to take this survey. How can they do that?
Yes, we have a website dedicated to our tool that I talked about, our exposure tool, as well as our survey, and that's buildcommunityresilience.com/Northeast Florida.
Okay, go to that website, take the survey starting Monday, and I'm going to make a quick plug once again for another website. It's our website here at WJCT, adaptflorida.org. Click on that website and opt in to getting coverage of adaptation efforts in Florida as we continue to cover this issue here at WJCT. Elizabeth Payne, CEO of the Northeast Florida Regional Council. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
And in a moment, we've got information, inspiration, and details about a special event for those on the First Coast living with sickle cell anemia. This is such an important medical issue, and so many local patients are affected, but there is hope and a symposium coming up this weekend. Keep listening here on the show. We'll have a lot more information in just a moment. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Candidates will take the stage for the first Democratic presidential debate. Expect them to cover topics from healthcare to income inequality.
I am not for free four-year college for all.
The best way to get there is by having Medicare for all.
I have some concerns with the Green New Deal.
Universal child care for every baby 0 to 5.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How the candidates compare to one another this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. I'm Robin Young. The late Bobby Cutler was the country's first national security advisor under Eisenhower. He was also secretly gay when that could get you fired. His old friend remembers being gay and working in national security.
You develop a certain crust that protects you against over-worrying a situation that you really can't do anything about.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, before it was understood what AIDS was or how it was spread, Dr. Paul Volberding and Nurse Cliff Morrison were treating AIDS patients at San Francisco General Hospital. The ward they worked on became a model for other AIDS units across the country and is the subject of the new documentary 5B. We'll talk with them about those days. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Google is getting into the housing market. It's investing in affordable housing around the San Francisco Bay Area. Stanford University also plans to spend billions on housing. Local governments across the country are struggling to save residents from getting priced out. What should be done about the housing crisis? And what does affordable even mean these days? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, approximately one in every 365 African-American children is born with sickle cell disease, a genetic blood disorder. At this time, there is no universal cure. But some local groups are working to provide help and hope for patients with sickle cell. And we're hearing all about it right now as we welcome Karen Patterson with Life South and Selena Webster Bass with the Voices Institute. They're organizing a sickle cell symposium this weekend. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. Selena, let's start with you. Let's define, for people that aren't familiar with this, what is sickle cell disease?
Yeah, so sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder, and it affects the red blood cells. So normal red blood cells are flexible, they're shaped like a donut, and move really easily through the blood vessels. But in the case of sickle cell disease, the red blood cells are shaped like bananas, and they tend to clump together, blocking blood flow, depleting the tissue of oxygen, causing all kinds of major complications, from strokes to acute chest syndrome, jaundice in the eyes. And the hallmark symptom of sickle cell disease is pain, excruciating pain for patients.
It's a painful, difficult disease and no cure, although there are some treatments, right?
Yes, there's no universal cure. There are stem cell transplants and, blood transfusions are one way to manage the pain. Of course, very strong pain medications for sickle cell patients, but there is no universal cure at this time.
Now, you have a very personal connection to sickle cell disease. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So I am a carrier of sickle cell trait, which means that I've inherited one sickle cell gene from one of my parents. And my husband also carries sickle cell trait. And when two parents have trait, there's a 25% chance of passing the gene on to your child. And so our firstborn son, Richard Anthony, was born with sickle cell. And he transitioned in August of 1999. And it was a very difficult thing. He was hospitalized numerous times, experienced blood transfusions. And so because of that, I'm very passionate about advocating for sickle cell families.
Sure. And I'm so sorry for the tragedy that happened in your family.
Thank you. Thank you.
And, this is a disease that affects African Americans.
It actually affects many groups of people,
but
mainly
African. It does not only affect African Americans.
Yes.
But I thank you for correcting me, because the perception, the inaccurate perception, is that this is a disease that only affects African Americans. So let's explain that that's not true.
Yeah.
It affects people all over the world, but in this country, more often than not, African Americans are susceptible to this.
Yes. So 1 in 400 African Americans are living with sickle cell. 1 in 16,000 Hispanic, Latinx Americans are living with sickle cell. And it affects European Americans, people from the Mediterranean, people from all over the world. And individuals who have sickle cell trait have a protective factor against malaria. So it was really a protective factor against malaria. And so we see the gene continues to be a spread. So, so it does not just impact African-Americans, but mainly African-Americans here in the United States.
So Karen Patterson, you're with Life South. How is Life South getting involved with helping patients and families here in our area deal with sickle cell disease?
Well, LifeSouth has the pleasure of working with Selena for the past several years, and we have a program called Sickle Cell Heroes. This program is where we match blood donors that have a closely matched blood type to the patients that are in need of blood transfusions to make it through those painful crises. So we encourage people to come out to the Sickle Cell Symposium on the 29th, hop on the Bloodmobile, and learn to see if you could possibly be one of those heroes to help save local lives here in First Coast.
And this is coming up. This is a free event this Saturday. Tell us more about what's happening.
Yeah, so it's really about educating, equipping, and empowering our community and sickle cell families. So we have Dr. Gauger from Nemours Children's Clinic, Dr. Nathawat from UF Health Jacksonville. We have a national speaker coming from University of Tennessee, Dr. Patricia Adams-Graves. We are also addressing mental health and sickle cell disease because oftentimes the dealing with the pain causes depression. And so we have Dr. Tiffany Williams with Masterpiece Counseling, and we have a sickle cell panel of families sharing their stories of resilience. And so we're really excited. We're asking everyone to come out. It's open to the community at large, as well as sickle cell families. We're asking people to come and donate blood, free lunch, free breakfast, and just connecting and creating a community of support for our sickle cell community.
This is such an important public health event for Jacksonville, and the LifeSouth Bloodmobile, as you said, Karen, will be there too. So lots going on.
Absolutely. Yes. We encourage everyone to come out, especially if you're an African-American donor. We'd love to see you. We welcome all to come out and help share the gift of life on the 29th.
Again, this is coming up this Saturday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at UF Health Shands Learning Resource Center. And that's at 655 8th Street. This is free, free breakfast, free lunch, and potentially a life-saving medical assistance for sickle cell disease. So, ladies, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Karen Patterson of LifeSouth and Selena Webster-Bass, Voices Institute. Again, that's Saturday and it's free. Thanks for coming here today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the battle against those algae blooms in our waterways. We'll look at that tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.